Welcome to the Current Cucurbit podcast series. I'm your host, Mark Gleason, a plant pathologist at Iowa State University. I'm also the leader of a USDA-funded research and outreach project that's looking for better ways to protect organic cucurbit crops, especially muskmelon and acorn squash, against a triple threat of diseases, pest insects, and weeds. The project includes scientists, students, and growers in three states, Iowa, New York, and Kentucky. Our podcast guest today is Dr. David Gonthier from University of Kentucky, Department of Entomology. And the topic he's going to talk about is pollination, and particularly pollination of crops. So, Dave, why do we care about pollination?
Thanks for having me, Mark. I think that's a very interesting question, and probably I really think that pollination doesn't quite get as much credit as we might think. You know, you hear about pollinators in the news and people worried about the bees, but that's, you know, news stories. We actually maybe don't quite submit enough money to supporting pollinators as you might think, and maybe we should. And I think there's a lot of different ways you can think of pollinators as being really important to all plants, but especially crops. I mean, some people think that pollinators are the reason, or pollination of plants is the reason we have so many different plant species out in the world today, from the great diversity you see in like the Amazon to different varieties and different species of plants that we eat and wild plants. And so the reason that is because they've caused a lot of different diversification of species, and because of the specialization of pollinators. But also about 35% of our food crops that we eat are at some level dependent on pollination from some sort of insect or an arthropod or maybe some other kind of organism in order to produce viable seeds for replanting that crop, or viable fruits and vegetables that we actually eat. And so without them, we might struggle to produce those 35% of our food crops successfully. And really what pollination is it's really, you know, the birds and the bees talk for plants. It's how plants create new individuals. And so what it is a plant has male parts, which are the pollen producing organs on male parts of the flower called anthers, and female parts, the pistil and the ovaries that have the eggs. And all pollination really is some sort of organism that's comes and takes those male gametes and moves them to the female part of the plant. And boom, you have fertilization of the egg, which then will develop into seeds and fruits and viable things that we eat and depend on. And without this fertilization, you really may not have much. There's a kind of a wide range of what how much plants are dependent on this pollination. But a lot of the things that we enjoy every day, from the cup of coffee in the morning to the squash and melons that we're focused on with this group, but also even things like strawberries to some degree are dependent on pollination. But it varies. Coffee, for example, it has a self-fertilization mechanism where it will still produce some seeds in some cases where there's no pollinators. But they found if you have bees or other pollinators there, you will see increased yields. And in fact, if you have a diversity of those pollinators, they often find that you'll have a greater yield. And strawberries are really not very dependent on pollination. They're very generalist, but without some form of moving that pollen, whether it be just an ant walking across the flowers, you may not have viable fruit formation. And so again, if you see it, some studies have shown that if you have a diversity of pollinators, you'll have higher quality fruit because that fertilization has occurred at a greater effect. And then there are things like the squash and melons that are pretty highly dependent for most species and most varieties on pollination. And so if you took a bag and put it over a female flower on a squash plant and didn't let anything pollinate it, that flower is not really going to turn into a viable fruit. It's probably going to kind of start to form into a fruit and then eventually abort and turn yellow and mold or die off and fall off the plant. And so it's a pretty fascinating and important thing.
So we're getting into the birds and bees or the nuts and bolts here. So who's really doing this work? I mean, you're talking about pollinators and you mentioned bees, but what kind of bees or pollinators are we really talking about here?
Right. And there's actually thousands of pollinator species out there. There's a real great diversity of them. And who does the work is really depends on the crop. We have, you know, these really fascinating relationships with certain kinds of bee species, like orchid bees that really find and pollinate a single or just a couple species of orchids. And they're extremely specialized in those plant species. Then you have your bumblebees and honeybees that are very big generalists, and they might pollinate all sorts of different kinds of crop plants. And if you take something like the cucurbit family with our squash and melons, you might find a range of things pollinating your cucurbits. There are specialists like the squash bees, which are two different genera or types of bees that have evolved with squash plants and from South America to North America. And they're quite fascinating, where if you grow lots of cucurbits, they'll find them. And eventually, if you kept growing them, you'll start to see more squash bees even nesting in the soils around those plots. But you also see bumblebees being very important, especially in here in North America. But there's a wide range of small native bees too. And of course you have honeybees, but they're not all exactly the same. There's been a lot of research trying to document who is the best pollinator for things like cucurbits. And oftentimes people find that these native wild bees are actually better. So people do these experiments where they kind of track a bee that pollinates a flower and no other bee has visited that flower, and they then bag the flower and watch to see how great a certain species is. And for everything from watermelons to cucumbers to summer and winter squash, there's been studies that often show these wild bees like bumblebees and squash bees and some other species that are called lasioglossums are often better than honeybees actually at pollinating cucurbit crops. Although honeybees can get the job done, they just usually are in such great abundance that they can overcome some of the poorer pollination effects.
Okay, so you mentioned that, you know, there's a concern about declining numbers of honeybees, and also that there's these native bees that we don't, you know, maybe they're going down too, we don't know, or maybe we do know. But what can people do about it? I mean, you know, scientists are one group, but what about farmers? Is there anything you can do to sort of increase the chances that your crops will be adequately pollinated?
Right. So there's actually a lot of research trying to figure out how to diversify agricultural landscapes so that you have enough flowers year round so that you can maintain wild bee populations on farm for whatever crops you grow, whenever you grow them. And so those are things like flowering hedgerows, which are really popular, and especially out west, and flower strips, which can be easily integrated within farms and don't take up too much space. and other diversification measures like trying to maintain natural habitats in or around your farm. Those are some of the on-farm strategies that people can do. But there are some other ways in which people are trying to find ways around pollination altogether. And that includes things like breeding cucumbers or summer squash or some other crops that are called parthenocarpic breeds or varieties, which really means they don't need to be fertilized in order to produce a viable fruit. And so some breeders have been successful in developing these varieties. And sometimes they're more, you know, everybody knows of seedless watermelons, which is slightly different process, but they're actually more sometimes popular amongst consumers because they don't really like the seeds. But one challenge with those is that they're actually still quite expensive. There's one grower here in Kentucky who told me that he grows them, but it costs about five times as much to buy those seeds as to buy a normal variety that's dependent on pollinators.
Suppose you've got some beehives on your farm. So let's just say some honeybee hives. Is that something that you can use, or is it worth the trouble to use those honeybees, maybe put the hives fairly close to where you're growing your squash and melon, or does it make any difference?
I think for honeybees, they have a very large foraging radius. So as long as they're able to find your crops, they likely will be able to pollinate for you. Other species like bumblebees have a smaller foraging radius. So with those kinds, you probably would want to keep them closer to the crop you want pollinated.
You're listening to the Current Cucurbit podcast series. I'm your host, Mark Gleason. Our three-year project is searching for more profitable and less pesticide-dependent ways to grow organic cucurbit crops. Now, back to our interview. And so, okay, a lot of cucurbit growers need to use pesticides, including insecticides. That applies to many organic growers as well as conventional growers, although the pesticides may be different. So how can a grower strike a balance between pesticide use and encouraging pollinators?
Right. I think that's one of the challenges of kind of sustainable management of vegetable crops these days is a lot of the insecticides that we're using aren't exactly perfectly targeted for the pests we want to control. So they have non-target effects on other organisms that oftentimes can be beneficial, like ladybugs or natural enemies of pests and pollinators. And so people often devise plans about trying to spray around when bees are active. So spraying late at night or very early in the morning, so that at least when you're spraying, you're not spraying while the bees might be flying through your field and you might decimate those bees from friendly fire. But it's interesting it's not just the synthetic chemicals that are harmful to bees. A lot of organic compliant pesticides are still potentially harmful. For example, pyrethrins that are the natural compound that are derived from chrysanthemum flower plants and are organic compliant can still have negative harmful effects on bees. And so it's still very advantageous to try to apply them in a way that will minimize the contact with the pollinators you probably depend on for that particular crop, especially in the case of cucurbits.
Okay, thanks, David. Now we're collaborating, you and I and some others in three different states are collaborating on a project having to do with a form of barrier strategy to protect cucurbit crops during the season called mesotunnels. This is just one of a spectrum of barrier strategies. We have low tunnels and we have high tunnels and a variety. So what are the challenges with some of these barrier type structures and strategies in trying to manage pollination?
Right. It's a very it's kind of a simple problem, but it's still a major challenge for these row cover or mesotunnel systems that we're working on, because essentially when you throw a net over a few rows of crops or a whole field, or you seal off a high tunnel, you're actually excluding all kinds of organisms, including pests, but also the pollinators. And so the challenge is, how do you devise a plan to get the pollinators in, but not get the pests into the fields? And so that's what our group here at Kentucky, as well as Iowa and Cornell, are trying with this study to come up with various strategies. Because we could take many different avenues, but they may all have different challenges and strengths. So we together have kind of come up with several different strategies. And some of them are commonly used with growers who are using this kind of row cover protective barrier. And some of them are still kind of experimental, and we're trying to work out the kinks. The simplest solution is, because the pest damage caused by things like cucumber beetles are most devastating when the plant is very young or just transplanted, that just putting this netting on for the beginning of the season, you can just take it off right as the plants begin to show female flower formation. And in so doing, then you're allowing wild bees to come and pollinate. Of course, the problem with that is that as soon as you open that net, then all of the cucumber beetles and squash bugs and squash vine borers and the diseases or pathogens that they carry or transmit will also now have access to your plot. And so that strategy is kind of the bare bones method, where it's really only protecting the plant at the beginning of the growing season, but you're still getting wild bee pollination, so you don't have to manage any bees. Through this research, and some even before me, like my collaborators here at UK, Dr. Rick Besson and Mark Williams, have also devised a strategy where you can do kind of keep the net on at the beginning of the season, so you get the great control, and take it off while the plants begin to flower. But then once they're finishing up flowering, you may then have the capability of spraying the plant and returning the net back onto the crop. And that way you're getting some control of these pests, but also are protecting the crop later in the season from any more of these pests that may want to access it. Of course, this can mean that you may trap some of the pests inside of the net, which can be a challenge, potentially causing high amounts of damage. And that's why you may or may not want to spray, depending on how many pests you're seeing in your field before you put that net back on. In some cases, it seems like you may not need to.
So this is partly a scouting challenge, right? You've got to get out there and walk your plots when they're exposed, right? To see what your pest status really is and whether it's, as you said, justified to put on a insecticide spray, for instance.
That's right. And so we really advocate trying to scout weekly to decide whether you're pests are at a level that meet a threshold where it would be advantageous to spray right before you put that net on for the remainder of the season until harvest time, of course.
Dave, you just described a strategy that the University of Kentucky researchers are calling on, off, on. So the protective barriers go on, and then they go off during bloom, and then they go back on for the rest of the season. But there's a little bit of a twist on this that we've tried as well. Would you care to describe that strategy?
Sure. So this is a strategy that's called the open-end strategy, where The idea is, or it's a question really, of how much of the net do you have to open in order for the pollinators to get in? And we've trialed this at Iowa and Kentucky and Cornell by just opening up the ends of the row cover tunnel, which allows only a couple meter opening on each side of the plot. And the idea here is maybe the bees are actually better at finding flowers than pests are at finding the plants. And so you may still minimize the amount of pests that are able to get in there, but the bees will be able to fly in and find the flowers easily enough to still provide adequate pollination.
What's been the experience with in Kentucky with how well that strategy has worked relative to, let's say, the on, off, on, or other treatments?
So here in Kentucky, we trialed this on some acorn squash plots that were pretty large, 120 feet long. And we compared some of these different strategies. And we really didn't see huge differences or any real statistical differences in the number of bees visiting flowers in any of these treatments. But we did see that this open ends treatment still provided the highest yield actually of all the treatments we studied, suggesting that whether there must have been enough pollination and the conditions were such that perhaps the pests were not getting in and we were finding the best yield actually. And we didn't see the pattern which you might expect, which is in the center of the plot, which is the furthest away from the openings, that there would be less bees and possibly less harvest. We actually found pretty consistent yield and bee visitation across the whole plot, which was interesting.
And Dave, I think you mentioned that, okay, the ends are open. And then after a couple of weeks of bloom, they're reclosed?
That's right. So similarly to the on-off-on strategy, you want to monitor the amount of female flowers and when they stop producing female, when the plants stop producing female flowers, you want to just close up the ends of the mesotunnel so that you're kind of closing it off to anybody else who want to get in, any of the pests, insects that could damage the crop.
And despite that shutting off of the pollinator access, you didn't see that protecting the plants for the rest of the season necessarily resulted in a sacrifice in yield?
Nope. We saw that the yield was highest and actually in this treatment. So we felt that, at least for us, under our conditions at our research farm, this seemed like the best strategy that we have going forward, actually.
Now, you know, this was, you're talking about the 2020 field results in Kentucky. Would you be comfortable going to, we're doing organic work, but would you be comfortable going to organic vegetable farmers in Kentucky and recommending this, let's say, open-end strategy now, or do you want more data first?
Yeah, I think it's... I wouldn't quite be ready to recommend it. We're still going to trial this one more time, at least next, this coming growing season. But in addition to that, while 120 feet is pretty long for a research plot, we work with some growers who are growing cucurbits and trying row covers on them that are growing 900 foot plots. And so we may need to even think about how every 100 feet or 200 feet, how much of the net do you want to lift up, as opposed to just opening the ends, I suppose. And so it could be that we need to keep thinking on what a larger scale commercial producer might have to do.
So you're saying that there might have to be, if I understand you correctly, there might have to be some customization or learning curve to fit this to a grower's particular circumstances?
Yeah, I think that's one next step. We are working with a couple growers that are were excited about our results and may trial it on their on-farm trials as part of this research next season. And they have, you know, it's an interesting situation because they often grow just three beds of cucurbits that are on these very long plots. And so we may need to think carefully about how often or at what segments do we open up those nets. But I think it does have some promise.
Here's a question that's a little more in the nitty-gritty of the research, but people are always interested in bees. But you said earlier that you were tracking the activity of bees at different points in these long plots. How exactly did you do this? You didn't have little televisions, did you? I mean, how did you get that information?
Yeah, so people who study pollination often will look at a simple measure of pollinator visitation to flowers. And if you do this, you can go and mark plants in your plot and crawl underneath the nets, for example, and find mark plants and then just follow how many bees are visiting flowers in that plant in a set amount of time. And so then you can just get access to how much activity there is of pollinators on those flowers. And it can vary depending on how long, of course, you set the time limit, but even with a minute, you can sometimes see great differences between treatments.
And apparently the bees aren't bothered by this anxious graduate student sitting among the plants?
we've seen that they're visiting flowers pretty frequently. So we felt that this seems pretty, okay, we usually try to stand back a meter or two, but at least in a spot where you can see the plant close enough to see the bees visiting the flowers.
So there'll be a couple of more years of field work here in Kentucky and the other states. Do you anticipate that the strategy will continue to be refined over that time?
Yeah, I think so. We have one last treatment that we were pretty excited about, which is actually purchasing bumblebee colonies and putting them in underneath the row covers, and then those bumblebees will be able to pollinate. And that seems to work really well on smaller plots, but we haven't seen it work so well on larger plots. But there could be some refinement in comparing these treatments and just seeing how many, maybe you need more than one colony to provide adequate pollination for these crops. And so that could be one angle we could go. But we have trialed these, but they're kind of a pain in some ways. We're finding that the squash plants grow up so big, it doesn't seem like they're able to pollinate so well underneath the row covers. It's a pretty confined space by the time the plants are flowering. And so we're kind of considering continuing on this direction of the open end strategy or some modifications of that. But this season, we're excited about what we found last year and hoping to repeat it and show at least 2 years with possibly different weather conditions that this will still hold true, that the opening just the ends or a small amount of the net is all you need to provide pollination success in these cucurbit fields.
So far anyway, it sounds like there's an evolution in the thinking towards simpler methods. I mean, when you put bees that are $150 a box under these nets, that's a pretty expensive thing to do, of course. And going towards the on-off-on or the open ends, it would perhaps be a less expensive, and then you don't have to worry about getting stung by a bee.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that's one way that we've listened to a lot of growers that have been working with us to try to think about making this simpler as well as less expensive. And adding up these small costs is important because it's not only, you know, the $150 is not that much on the scheme of things, but it's also challenging to make sure that those bees are the beehive that you purchased is actually doing its function. It can also be tricky to order them and time it just right so that you have these bees and they're not sitting somewhere for too long before your plants are flowering. And with COVID, it can be a little tricky as well. Things are harder to order or sometimes in great demand, so there's not very many of them. Or it's just, it's a bit of a challenge, I think. Unless you have a great place to keep the bees when they're not in your squash fields.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Current Cucurbit podcast series. You can find more episodes in the series at the Current Cucurbit website. The link is www.cucurbit.iastate.edu. That's www.cucurbit.plantpath.iastate.edu. The host for this series is Mark Gleason. Jose Gonzalez is the editor. The Current Cucurbit podcast series is funded by a grant from USDA's Organic Research and Extension Initiative. For more information about the three-state project, contact Mark Gleason at mgleason@iastate.edu or Sarah Pethybridge at sjp277@cornell.edu in New York, or David Gonthier, djgo227@g.uky.edu in Kentucky.